Secret Agent Man. Secret Agent Man. They're giving you a number and taking away your name.
Hello and welcome to the podcast in which manners maketh man. It's Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a man who likes to end everything on a questionable anal sex joke.
Mike Tadricio.
How you doing today, Mike?
I'm pretty good. I'm a little worried about whether or not you use that intro, not my intro, the manners maketh the man, in our first review, but I assume you did your research.
I'm pretty sure back when we did the first review, because that was like episode 3, I don't think I was doing unique intros for the podcast at that point.
Oh, was that long ago?
Yeah. Wow. That was way back in the day of our early podcasting years. So yeah, I think at that point I was just saying hello and welcome to Film Bookcast before we had really developed our voice. Now we are podcasting extraordinaires and we can do silly intros at the beginning of everything. That was
we've earned that right.
Exactly. So if you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we do some goofy intro and then we move on into film news, in which we talk about what's going on in the film world. And then we do our discussions, where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we move on into our featured review. This week, we are discussing the new film from director Matthew Vaughn and the sequel to Kingsman: The Secret Service. It's Kingsman: The Golden Circle. Now, are you excited to dig into Kingsman 2, Mike?
I am.
Yeah, good, good. I'm very excited to discuss it with you. And we will do that in due time. But for now... but for now, we got to get into some film news.
Hi, it's time for.
What?
It's time for. It's time for.
It's the film news.
Hi, it's time for.
What?
It's time for. It's time for.
It's the film news. Film news.
All right, it's time for film news here on Film Bookcast, Mike, and we begin with some news that normally I would be pretty trepidatious about, but I gotta say, I'm kind of intrigued by all this, and I hate being intrigued by all this, because I believe when we reviewed the last movie in this franchise, I said to you, I'm pretty sure I said these exact words, I never want to see another movie in this franchise again.
That sounds about right.
I have been burned so many times by this franchise, Mike. I did not think I had it in me to look forward to another one of these, but we're getting another Terminator movie, Mike, and Terminator 6 is a thing that is happening. I honestly thought Terminator Genesis would be the end of it all.
I really
thought that was going to be the end of it. Like that movie kind of bombed the box office. It didn't do too well critically. Critically it did terribly. And I genuinely thought it was one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my entire life. Outside of maybe Terminator Salvation, which was another one that I thought was just terrible.
Terminator is the best two movie franchise of all time.
Exactly. Honestly, I kind of like Terminator 3. Like, I feel like that's an okay movie.
I feel like I do too. It's been a while since I've seen it.
Yeah, but... I haven't seen it since I was 10, but 10-year-old Mike really liked it.
And that's the basis for your whole life.
Exactly. If 10-year-old Mike likes something, it has to be good. but in any case, Mike, Terminator 6 looks like it's going to be happening, and here's the thing that's starting to intrigue me about this. So James Cameron has been talking about this for a little while now, and apparently he's actually producing Terminator 6. Now, he's credited on Terminator 4 and 5 and 3 as, like, an executive producer, but he didn't really have any involvement in those movies. This one he's been building from the ground up because the rights to Terminator actually revert back to him in 2019. And so that's why over the past few years you've seen the studios trying to just push out a Terminator movie because they knew no matter what, the rights were going back to James Cameron.
Right.
And I guess at this point, the studios aren't going to do another Terminator movie because they don't have enough time to make one before 2019 hits. So James Cameron is able to start getting this thing off the ground. And supposedly this one will hit in July 2019. It's pretty soonish. It's less than 2 years away. It's being directed by Tim Miller, the guy who directed Deadpool. And this is the really exciting news. Linda Hamilton will be returning to her role as Sarah Connor for Terminator 6.
Yeah, that's the most exciting part of this.
Yeah, I think so.
Otherwise, who really cares?
Yeah, I mean, otherwise, like, I'd still be mildly intrigued because, like, if James Cameron is involved with something, I usually pay attention. And Tim Miller is fine. You know, I thought Deadpool was fine, and, like, you know, I'll watch what he does, but I don't know. James Cameron's the name that really draws me to it. But Linda Hamilton, man, that is cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to see James Cameron take a break from being sexist against Patty Jenkins to go back to the Terminator franchise. You know, he could really use a break right now, I think.
Exactly. Fair enough. Yeah, but also this news kind of comes right off the heels of Jamie Lee Curtis returning to the Halloween franchise.
Right.
Which is another strong female character that's been absent from franchise for a long time, which is kind of strange that they both happened at the same time. But anyway, yeah, so she's coming back. Also, Schwarzenegger will be back, obviously.
What else has he got going?
I am curious who they're going to cast as John Connor if they bring back somebody who's played him before. Because a different person plays John Connor in every single movie. My ideal John Connor would probably be like an Olsen Twins thing on Full House where they like swap out the John Connors like seamlessly.
It's Dr. Parnassus.
So it's like first it'll be Edward Furlong, and then Nick Stahl will jump in for a scene, and then Christian Bale will jump in, and who's it, Jason Clarke in Terminator 5, he jumps in. Yeah, they all just kind of swap scenes, and then throw in Thomas Dekker, who's John Connor in Sarah Connor Chronicles TV show.
Yeah, it'd be great.
Throw him in too. Actually, Josh Friedman, who created the Sarah Connor Chronicles TV show, is one of the writers on this new Terminator. He's one of the creative voices developing this new Terminator, which is really exciting also, because I don't know if you ever watched that show. It was dope. No. It was dope as hell.
I believe you.
Yeah, it was a really cool show. So it's still Terminator 6. I've said before, like, I don't want to see any more Terminator movies, especially since like the franchise was over at the end of 2. Like there's basically no way you can go past that. And Terminator 3 like has some fun moments and is, I think, ends really well. And I think that's a pretty good ending for the series too. And 4 and 5 are just garbage. Also, both of those tried to kickstart a new trilogy of films. Neither one panned out, and this one is also trying to kickstart a new trilogy of films.
Yeah, why not? You know, just go for it.
Yeah, fucking go all in, I guess. I mean, this.
Yeah.
I feel like this has to be the last chance for the Terminator franchise. Like, if this fails, there's no way it comes back from this, right?
Yeah. I mean, they're quickly approaching the kind of like Friday the 13th / and Halloween just kind of level of just like, sure, who cares? Just there's a new robot that just comes and kills everyone. Why does it matter?
Yeah.
Let's just go with that kind of thing. And. We'll see what happens after Terminator 6, but I'd kind of be down if they just became, like, a really low-budget, like, summer movie that came out every year, same day every year, and it's just always some ridiculous,
some, like Purge, where it's, like, $5 million for a Terminator movie, and...
Yeah, give it to Blumhouse, and just let them make it. That'd be great.
Yeah, that'd be something. Also about Terminator 6, actually, apparently this one will also probably ignore most of the Terminator sequels outside of 2.
What a coincidence.
Yeah. And I feel like for most franchises, I'm like, you know, it's weird. It's a weird thing that the Halloween movies are doing that. The new Halloween is supposed to be doing that too. There's talk that the Neil Blomkamp's supposed Alien movie would have done that if that ever came to be. Jurassic World kind of does that with Jurassic Park 2 and 3. And on the one hand, like, you want to, you know, jettison the ones that don't work so well. Like, that's fine. I feel like most of those franchises, like, I don't really need them to do that. You can just, like, I think Creed's a great example of something that building on a franchise, even the silly ones. Like, Creed takes all of its emotional stakes out of Rocky IV, which is the silliest of the Rocky movies, and it does something great with them. And so it's, you know, there's genuine, like, pathos to what it does there. But if they're going to erase stuff in the franchise, I feel like Terminator is the franchise best suited to doing that because of all the time travel-y, wibbly-wobbly nonsense.
Yeah, you get the most leeway to just pretend things didn't happen.
Exactly. So that's kind of nice. And in the meantime, James Cameron has finally actually started filming those Avatar sequels that we've heard so much about for so long at this point.
All seven of them.
All seven of them. Yeah, I mean, there's in reality, I think there's 4 of them. He's shooting them all at the same time. This will probably take a long, long time to film, I would imagine. But
so he's gonna stop and film. Oh, he's not actually filming and being involved that heavily in Terminator 6. I forgot.
I mean, he's producing it and working on the story and stuff like that, but Tim Miller is the director of that movie.
Right.
In any case, he's focusing most of his energy on Avatar, I believe, at this point. And as he has been doing for the past 10 years.
Yeah.
Really the more past, like, 15, 20 years, because that's about as long as the first Avatar, like, the original Avatar took, like, 10 years to make, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, did you see the new SNL by any chance? The new Saturday Night
Live? I did not see it, but I heard about the Avatar skit.
It was pretty amazing.
I'll have to go find it.
You gotta check that out. Hashtag Papyrus. Anyway, let's move on into the next bit of film news. Phil Lord and Chris Miller, Mike, two directors who I'm a big fan of, and I know you like as well. They were attached to make that Han Solo movie for Star Wars. Didn't pan out, as we are well aware, they got fired from that movie, but they have finally lined up their first project since being fired from Star Wars, and it's called Artemis, which is an adaptation of an upcoming sci-fi novel written by Andy Weir, who is the author of The Martian. Now, Mike, you've read The Martian.
Yeah.
I have not. So can you shed a little light on his style and what you think we might be able to expect from this movie?
I think we'll be able to expect lots of quippy one-liner stuff. There's a lot of that. Martian is a very unique novel and movie for the most part, in that it's mostly just one character. So like there isn't a whole lot of opportunity for like comedy, I guess. But there are a lot of really funny moments. Just that that character's approach to everything that's happening to him is with a sarcastic quip. Right. So like I'm sure that works well with Phil Lord and Chris Miller. Like, I'm in.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to throw that out there, because I just wanted to take note of Phil Lord and Chris Miller moving on to something else. I don't really know that much about Artemis other than that it's a new sci-fi novel. I think it's going to be a little more fantastical than The Martian, actually.
Yeah.
The Martian's more, like, pretty hard sci-fi when it comes down to it. Like, it's more of a science novel than it's a science fiction kind of thing.
Yes, yeah. So I'm definitely excited for more Andy Weir stuff. I really like The Martian book. The movie was pretty good, I guess. So I'm excited to see his new stuff and to know that it's going to be a Phil Lord and Chris Miller movie. That'll be fun.
Yeah, that'll be pretty cool. So we'll move on from that. And then we have some WTF news that I wanted to mention here.
Shrek 5 was delayed.
I know, man. How could they? 2026, that is way too long. But they really got to get the pores right on all of Shrek's green skin.
you were struggling so hard to get there.
In any case, no, that's not the WTF news we're talking about today, although we will have a separate podcast just about that. One of our favorite movies last year was The Nice Guys, Mike. We were both huge fans of that movie.
Yes.
And now producer Joel Silver has revealed that he's working on a new TV adaptation of The Nice Guys, which could be interesting. Like, actually, when The Nice Guys, when we came out of The Nice Guys, I was like, I would watch a TV show with these characters, just, being bumbling idiot cops in the 70s. Like, that would be amazing. But the TV show doesn't sound like it's The Nice Guys at all. It's going to be a gender-swapped TV reboot of The Nice Guys set in the present day without Shane Black's involvement. So, A, it's not The Nice Guys anymore. It's The Nice Girls.
which I'm down. Sure.
Sure. I'm all on board with the gender-swapping thing. Like, I like the new Ghostbusters. I'm looking forward to Ocean's 8. I think that looks pretty cool. But I don't know. I feel like The Nice Guys, like, A, you're removing the chemistry between those two leads, Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling, who were the best in that movie. Also, like, that movie was in the 70s. Like, that was a 70s set movie. And removing it from that time period, I feel like it makes it not The Nice Guys anymore. Like, it's
you remove the two biggest components to me that you're removing is the setting, the time period, the 70s. That movie was so much about being in the 70s.
Yeah.
And Shane Black's involvement. Yes. Without him being around, what's even the point?
Exactly. Also, they're putting this on network TV, which really seems to sanitize everything about The Nice Guys. Like, that was a movie that featured copious amounts of nudity and vulgarity, and it's just not something that I think would work. It has to be like really watered down to work on something like Fox. So I don't know.
As the lead in to Modern Family.
Well, that's on ABC, Mike. So
You know what I mean.
Yeah, I get it, though. I mean, this is Joel Silver, who is also a producer of the Lethal Weapon TV show. So he has experience adapting a Shane Black property into network TV. So I guess that's kind of his thought process. But I don't know, man. This just seems like a bad idea written all. I doubt this actually happens, But wanted to bring it up because it's super weird. And then other news, studios are working on new reboots of Charlie's Angels, and that one will be directed by Elizabeth Banks, possibly starring Kristen Stewart and Lupita Nyong'o as two of the angels.
Wow, I'm in. That sounds fucking dope. Whatever that is, it's amazing.
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting. And then they're also working on a Men in Black sort of reboot spinoff, which would be a spinoff that does not feature Will Smith or Tommy Lee Jones, but instead introduces some new characters to fill in the Men in Black shoes. And
will Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill be in there?
As of right now, no, I don't think that's the case. I think they're actually working. I think that's still like in the works, the Men in Black 21 Jump Street thing that they were throwing around. But I think they want to get this movie made first, so that way, like, it's an actual crossover, like, of these two characters into the... I would rather see Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones hanging out with, you know, Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum, but that's probably not going to happen. I doubt either of them would do that movie, and I could see this, like, kind of being the launch pad into whatever stupid cinematic universe they want to make.
Yeah.
But otherwise, yeah. But it sounds like you're pretty excited about Charlie's Angels, Mike. I didn't realize that you're... I'll be honest.
I've never seen
the original Charlie's Angels. Or the movie version, anyway.
Yeah, I definitely had seen those movies.
Yeah.
I don't really remember. I remember Sam Rockwell dancing in the first one, so, like, there's that.
You can say that about most movies that Sam Rockwell is in.
He dances in every movie. Yeah. I can't help it. Like. But, yeah, I mean, that just sounds like not what I would expect Charlie's Angels to be, like, with Kristen Stewart and Lupita Nyong'o and directed by Elizabeth Banks. Like. Yeah. Let's just go on an adventure, Mike.
Yes.
Let's go on a cinematic Charlie's Angels adventure.
Those are all names who I enjoy, and Charlie's Angels, not something I...
don't not enjoy.
Yeah, not something I hold dear to my heart, so they can do whatever they want to it, you know, kind of, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, exactly. It's not the nice guys.
Yeah, it's not the nice guys. So
I draw the line at nice guys.
That's exactly it. So yeah, Charlie's Angels, Men in Black. So we'll see how those things pan out if they end up panning out at all. Finally, we got one last bit of news, and this isn't really film news, but I felt like I should talk about it anyway. Tom Petty news broke out like a couple of hours ago, actually, as we're recording this, that Tom Petty has passed away at the age of, I think, 66 due to a heart attack. Crazy shocking.
Yeah,
in all respects, he's one of the most iconic rock musicians of all time. I actually saw him just 4 months ago at Mountain Jam.
That's right.
Live, and he was amazing. It was one of the best shows I've ever seen. And he's occasionally appeared on film and TV in the past, most notably playing himself as a recurring character on It's Gary Shandling's show, which was Gary Shandling's show in the 80s. And he did also appear on The Simpsons.
Lyrics are the hardest part of songwriting. But when you come up with something meaningful and heartfelt...
Boring!
Will you stop saying that?
But rock stars are supposed to be about drinking and getting drunk and boozing it up.
And girls that have legs and know how to use them.
And why I can't drive 55.
You just want mindless generic rock?
Precisely.
See that drunk girl speeding down the street?
Yeah!
She's worried about the state of public schools.
Boo!
She likes to party. She likes to rock.
Yeah!
She prays that our schools don't run out of chalk.
And this Comedy Central animated sitcom that I really liked back when it was on called Little Bush.
Wow.
You remember that show?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I think he appeared as himself in, like, the season finale of that show. But his music is also used to really critical effect in so many things. I mean, the scene that jumps to my mind is in Silence of the Lambs. When the girl is singing American Girl in the car and then some bad shit happens to her right afterwards. But yeah, that scene jumps to mind. Also, Tom Cruise sings along to Free Fall On and Jerry Maguire. So there's a lot of moments in movies and television that, you know, focus on the music of Tom Petty. And to me, he was just like an artist that, like, embodied America in a weird way. Like, he was very distinctly American.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of his biggest songs is American Girl, Mike.
Yes, that's true.
no, but I do agree. He does kind of have this Americana motif to all of his music and just kind of his general persona, I think.
Yeah.
He's a very American rock music legacy.
Yeah, absolutely. And he captured that feeling, I think, with a touch of melancholy as well. Like, his music is often very sad, but it's, like, played very upbeat. It kind of has, like, this mix of emotions that I think works really well. So just wanted to say RIP Tom Petty, even though it's not really strictly a film or TV related thing. Just very sad news indeed. But we should move on, Mike. Let's get into our discussions.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
So today, I have another movie from my big list that we've been calling my 80s-a-palooza list. It's not strictly true in the definition of the word true. there's a lot of 90s movies on here.
So you've just been lying this whole time.
I've been lying. It's more like the lie book cast. I tried.
Gave it a shot.
Hey, that's all that counts.
Yeah.
But this week I watched 1995's Mortal Kombat. The very same Mortal Kombat movie that you just quoted.
Yeah.
The
one line that quotes Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, that's all you need, really. This is... I'm going to get into that, don't worry. This is based on the, I don't know when, video game that came out, early 90s, I guess, maybe late 80s. I don't know exactly. Probably could have looked it up, but I didn't, because who prepares?
I'm pretty sure Mortal Kombat was an early 90s game.
I know it's one of the, you know, that era.
Yeah, that's like 91, 92 kind of thing.
Yeah. So I went into this I feel like I had probably seen it as a little kid. I was a little young when this movie came out to have seen it in theaters, but I probably seen it at some point. And I went in expecting not good things at all. Of course not.
Right.
But I was hoping for it to be redeemed in just that kind of glorious 90s pseudo kung fu movie cheesiness. And it kind of mostly didn't deliver on any of those words. It's just straight up bad for a lot, most of it. There are some cool fights, particularly the guy playing Liu Kang is able to, you know, seems like a competent martial artist. So any of the times he's on screen fighting is pretty cool. There's some comedic bits I think that are really funny. The guy that plays Johnny Cage and the woman that plays, oh man, I forgot her name already. But whatever, the three of them are kind of our main protagonists, and they have a fun chemistry going on, just spouting ridiculous one-liners at each other.
Yeah.
But most of the movie seems to be plot working towards an opportunity to say either fatality, finish him, or flawless victory, which are all quotes from the video game, if anyone doesn't know, so for some reason. Which, like, is fine if they felt at all, like, appropriate. Like, there's a random point where they have a, you know, there's a big battle, like the big climactic battle, and Liu Kang, just after getting his ass handed to him and eventually winning, you know, come from behind, just says flawless victory. Like, no, that's what? That doesn't make any sense. Like, there's probably weird shit. And it, of course, features that kind of beautiful, like, just mid-90s clip art computer animation for some of it. It's really skittiness.
Yeah.
Goros, I think, is the guy with forearms, is like this weird, creepy, like animatronic. He kind of looked like the Ninja Turtles from the 90s Ninja Turtle movies, but like clearly not a dude in a suit, like just like a shitty version of that. I don't know. It was real weird. But moral of the story is Mortal Kombat's on Netflix. Just don't even bother. Just move on. And I would like to point out too, so they seem to be working towards all these moments where they can quote the video game or just straight up play the theme song over a fight scene. Like the straight, like, I was not expecting that at all, which was hilarious. Yeah, the first time it happens, and it's just like, prove your might, like, and it's just like a regular fight scene happening. Just not ready for it. So there is this is kind of like a riff tracks level, like, kind of movie, I think, you know, or Mystery Science Theater thing, like, hang out with your friends and make fun of this bad movie.
Yeah.
But watching it alone at 9 o'clock on a Saturday night, like, not a good choice. Made a mistake on that one.
Definitely sounds like a really sad Saturday night.
Yes, it was indeed.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen Mortal Kombat, not since I was a kid, though. Like, I was probably like 9 or 10 when I watched it. Have you seen the sequel? Did you know there was a sequel?
I knew there was a sequel. I don't remember if I've seen it or not, though.
Mortal Kombat Annihilation, and it's worse.
Wow, that's impressive.
Right? And in that one, most of the roles are recast, too. And I think the ones that aren't recast get killed off really early on.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it is not a good movie. I would recommend watching the nostalgic critic review of it rather than the...
That seems like a fair yes. Yeah, but, do that.
It's a pretty entertaining review. But yeah, Mortal Kombat, you're saying skip, even though it's on Netflix. So people can watch
probably
it.
Probably just pass.
Yeah.
Unless you have a bunch of friends and you're drunk and you want to make fun of a bad movie, go ahead.
Yeah, unless you really like the Mortal Kombat theme song, which you should.
It is the best theme song of all time.
If you happen to take karate in the mid-2000s, you heard that theme song nonstop. And I know that because I took karate in the mid-2000s.
Perfect.
Anyway, yes, so that's Mortal Kombat, available on Netflix now. And then I've got a bunch of movies I want to talk about today, Mike. The first of which is called Brad Status. And this is the new movie directed by Mike White, who is a comedian who's been working pretty steadily for about 20-ish years now. He was the creator of the HBO show Enlightened with Laura Dern. He does, I usually like his work. It's pretty solid. Like it's usually pretty funny, but it also has a lot of like emotion and drama mixed in as well. And this is kind of the newest entry into the Ben Stiller is having a midlife crisis genre of film, which I say that's a genre because I feel like it's the only kind of role that Ben Stiller plays now. I was going through them in my head and there's like, While We're Young is a midlife crisis Ben Stiller movie, Secret Life of Walter Mitty, Greenberg, this movie, Brad Status, I guess Zoolander 2 might count as that.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't see Zoolander 2. I'm just assuming that it is.
From whatever.
That's more of a metatextual thing where I'm seeing Ben Stiller as Zoolander. I'm thinking like, man, he must be having some kind of midlife crisis. But anyway, yeah, Brad Status is really solid. It gives you a very internal look at this kind of self-defeating protagonist and calls him out on his shit a lot of the time. And it's pretty entertaining on that front. So Brad Status, worth checking out. And then I also saw American Made. And this is the new movie directed by Doug Liman, who was the director of The Bourne Identity and most recently Edge of Tomorrow. And this also stars Tom Cruise. And this is kind of like Tom Cruise's own Wolf of Wall Street. Or at least it's his attempt at that. It's more like his Lord of War.
What a crossover between our podcasts. Yeah, like.
I guess so. And the result is like solid. It's a pretty decent movie. He plays Barry Seal, who works for the CIA while running drugs for the cartel that would give birth to Pablo Escobar in the 80s. And it's a pretty fascinating story. It's really interesting. It's got some fun sequences and a really good Tom Cruise performance at its center. It is weird that present-day Tom Cruise is playing a pilot in the 80s when he rose to fame as young Tom Cruise playing a pilot in the 80s. Do you know what I mean? Wow.
Yep.
It's
yep.
This weird kind of circular thing. Like, man, it's this is like the sequel to Top Gun 2. This is the sequel to Top Gun that we didn't really realize that we needed. And apparently he's actually working on a sequel to Top Gun. But yep. At this point, like, why? Because he just made this movie. And it's like, I doubt a sequel to Top Gun will be any good. I feel like this is as good as that's going to get. So... Yeah.
So just hang it up now.
Yeah, just hang it up now. But anyway, yeah, that's American Made. And then I also wanted to talk about Stronger, which is the new movie directed by David Gordon Green. Now, his career is a really interesting one to me. He has done so much different kinds of stuff. Like, he first came onto the scene this drama called George Washington, and then he worked in stoner comedy for a while. He did Pineapple Express. And he did, like, Your Highness and The Sitter. He's worked on Eastbound and Down and Vice Principals. But also he did, like, the Sandra Bullock drama Our Brand is Crisis. He did the Nicolas Cage drama Joe, which we'll talk about, 5 years from now. But and he's the director of the upcoming Halloween movie that he's writing with Danny McBride. So this is a drama about a man who lost his legs in the Boston Marathon bombing. Stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Tatiana Maslany. And this is much better than the kind of inspirational true story movie that this usually turns into. You know what I mean? Like, these kind of based on true events. Like, this person overcame such adversity. And, like, I'm usually not really into those movies, to be quite honest. But this one, I think, really focuses on investing you in its characters rather than dwell on the actual incidents. And I think by doing that, it succeeds in kind of telling a more compelling story. So I wanted to give a shout-out to Stronger. And then I also wanted to mention Gerald's Game. And this is the movie I'm most excited to talk about today, Mike, because this is the new movie directed by Mike Flanagan, who I have been championing on this podcast for so long. It feels like I've been like talking about him for a while, but he was the director of Hush, which is a great Netflix original horror movie that I talked about, I think, last year. He also was the director of Ouija, Origin of Evil, a.k.a. Ouija 2, which is dope as hell. I've talked about that in the past. Ouija 2 is fucking great, and I couldn't
That's make... still my favorite thing that you've ever talked about.
And I couldn't make it through the first Ouija. Like, the first Ouija is garbage. Ouija 2, though, is so much fun. Anyway, Gerald's Game is the new Netflix original, adapted from a Stephen King story, and it stars Carla Gugino, Bruce Greenwood, and Henry Thomas. If you don't remember Henry Thomas, he was the kid in E.T. He was Elliot.
Wow.
Yeah, he was also in Ouija 2, actually. And I really don't want to give too much away about what this movie is, other than it's really good. It kind of falters a little bit towards the end, but it's a really intense ride throughout the whole time. It's got a great central performance from Carla Gugino. It has some really intense things going on in terms of what she's doing, what Bruce Greenwood is doing, and just a really big fan of this movie. I mean, it's very much like a one-location thriller kind of thing, which we talked about a little bit last week for our Complete Works episode. We talked about Oliver Stone's World Trade Center and how we took this kind of potentially a really interesting story about these two men trapped under rubble, but it's a kind of inherently uncinematic story. And so in order to compensate for that, you need to do something more than that. And I don't think Oliver Stone did with that movie. I think Gerald's Game is kind of similar in that regard. Like it's a person trapped in one location for a long period of time. And I think this movie is a lot more cinematic than World Trade Center is. It does a lot more stuff, notably with the performance of Carlo Gugino, but like with the camera angles and what it's doing and the kind of atmosphere that it creates, it's really solid stuff. And Mike Flanagan, man, he can do no wrong at this point. Like he's doing really solid work in horror movies right now. So if anybody goes see any of the movies that I'm talking about, this one's the easiest to access, because it is available on Netflix and it is the best one that I'm talking about. So Gerald's Game, go watch it. It is real good.
And there you go.
Then finally, I have one last thing to talk about, Mike. Curb Your Enthusiasm is back. So excited. episode 1 aired last night, so there's only been one episode so far. And I'm a big fan of where the season looks like it's going. I've been a big fan of the show for a long time. And it's been off the air for 6 years. So it's not like this. It's a pretty anticipated return for this show. But it's not like something like Twin Peaks, where it's like we never thought we would ever have new Curb Enthusiasm again. I wasn't sure if we would ever have Curb again, because Larry David's always been kind of like, yeah, like maybe. Doing his Larry David thing. You know, we'll see what happens. Like he has an open relationship with HBO where whenever he wants to make a new Curb season, they will make it. They will finance it for him, which is great. You know, that's an awesome deal that he has. But that also means he can take as long of a break as he wants to do whatever and then come back whenever. So it's been 6 years since Curb last year, which is the longest gap that there's ever been for Curb Enthusiasm, I think. And episode 1 aired last night, and it is just it just hits the ground running. It's so good. I'm a big fan of where the season looks like it's going to be going, and I'm just so happy to have Larry David fucking things up on my TV again. Are you a fan of Curb Enthusiasm, Mike? Have you watched the show?
That's a show that I've never like watched the whole run of. I've watched episodes of it. Like I kind of just bounce around. You know, it's kind of always on, or at least was.
Okay.
Always just on. It's like I've seen episodes here and there, and I enjoy it. I've just never gone and bothered to watch the whole thing or anything.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think I jumped onto it when it was season 7. I jumped on because they were doing the Seinfeld reunion thing.
Right.
Because I was a huge fan of Seinfeld, and I found out they were doing this reunion show, and I hadn't watched any Curb Enthusiasm. But I just watched that season of it. And then once I did, I ended up watching the rest of it, like, you know, afterwards. But it's one of my favorite shows, so I'm very glad it's back doing its thing. And that, I think, wraps up our discussions, Mike. We should move on. Let us do that with our featured review of Kingsman: The Golden Circle.
Eggsy, I saw in you what someone once saw in me. Something that can't be taught. The makings of a Kingsman. Being a Kingsman is more than the clothing we wear or the weapons we bear. It's about being willing to sacrifice for the greater good. I hope you're ready for what comes next.
All right, that was from the trailer for Kingsman: The Golden Circle, written by Matthew Vaughn and Jane Goldman, and directed by Matthew Vaughn. Taron Egerton, Mark Strong, Julianne Moore, Halle Berry, Channing Tatum, Pedro Pascal, Jeff Bridges are all in the cast of this movie. And spoilers if you haven't watched the trailers yet, I guess. Have you watched any of the trailers for Kingsman 2, Mike?
Yeah, I had seen it.
Okay, so if you have not watched the trailers for Kingsman 2, I'm about to spoil an actor who appears in this movie that you might want to be surprised if you haven't watched the trailers. But it is in the trailers, so we're going to talk about it. Colin Firth is in this movie again, so I wanted to just throw that out there. I'm sorry if I spoiled it for you, but I think I gave you enough warning. ahead of time. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Kingsman: The Golden Circle reads, "When their headquarters are destroyed and the world is held hostage, the Kingsman's journey leads them to the discovery of an allied spy organization in the U.S. These two elite secret organizations must band together to defeat a common enemy." That's actually probably the best IMDb plot synopsis we've had in a very long time.
Well done, IMDb.
Yeah.
Well done.
Exactly. So, Mike, we reviewed Kingsman: The Secret Service way back in the early days of this podcast, and I'm pretty sure we established some of our thoughts on Matthew Vaughn in that episode, but it's been a while, so I'll just say that I'm a big fan of director Matthew Vaughn. who's made films like Kick-Ass and X-Men First Class before directing 2015's Kingsman: The Secret Service. And honestly, I think that might be his best movie. Like, Kingsman 1, I think, is arguably his best. Although it's been a few years since I've watched Kick-Ass. I've actually been waiting. I've been thinking about like wanting to rewatch it, but I've been waiting because we're going to rewatch it for Complete Works at some point. So I'm putting it off for a little bit.
But did he also make Layer Cake? I feel like I remember that too.
He made Layer Cake and Stardust as well.
Okay.
So Layer Cake was his first movie. Although before that, he was the producer for Guy Ritchie's films.
Right.
And specifically, he was the producer for Guy Ritchie's good films, Lock, Stock, and Snatch. I think it was at that point.
That just seems like. Like that would be the title of the movie Lock, Stock, and Snatch.
Those are two different movies.
Sorry.
But and that's kind of like he and Guy Ritchie were kind of a team for a little while, and then Matthew Vaughn kind of broke off to do his own thing. I think at that point Guy Ritchie got into a relationship with Madonna and things got stressed between the two of them, like him and Matthew Vaughn, and so Matthew Vaughn left to do his own movies. And I gotta say, Matthew Vaughn stuff, I think it's leagues ahead of Guy Ritchie's stuff. I think he was like the real talent in that partnership going on there. I feel like I like Lock, Stock, and Snatch as much as I do because of Matthew Vaughn's input in those movies.
Yeah, that's definitely possible. I think I'm one of the really weirdos that really likes Rock and Rolla.
Okay, that's fair.
But you're not wrong. Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch are the, like, his crowning achievements, I think.
Absolutely. So, and Kingsman: The Secret Service, which came out in 2015, kind of functioned as both a parody and also an entry into the campy, like, 70s and 80s James Bond canon. So, like, it's Bond, but with the violence and the sex and the vulgarity just turned up to 11. And it's a blast. I mean, that first movie is so much fun. We reviewed it way back in episode 3. You can listen to it at filmbook.com if you want to. If you want to listen to us stammer even more than we do now.
Listen to how much we've grown.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk about Kingsman 2 a little bit. I do think it starts pretty strong. And it ends even stronger. I do think it sags a lot in the middle. Like there's like a middle hour where I was just like, I think the movie's kind of all over the place for me without any kind of focus for that long time. But I'm curious what you thought, Mike. What did you think of Kingsman 2?
Yeah, I guess I had a similar experience or a similar reaction to it. I was really on board. I was having a lot of fun. I loved the kind of the spoof of the hot start that James Bond movies all have. Like, immediately we're in that action, and you know, it was fun to be back in that cranks, like you said, cranks to 11 James Bond super spy espionage world. Because I think that's just a lot of fun in general, and it's such a fun take on that. Like, you know, the Bourne movie, I mean, it's kind of the same stuff I said in the first review. Like, the Bourne movies are the kind of like grimdark serious version of that, and then we just get this ridiculous campiness of the Kingsman movies. But that said, a lot of it, Kingsman 2 did feel samey. It felt like we were kind of just doing the same type of stuff that we did in the first one. Which I don't know if that's if we want to give more credit to the movie than it is trying to do. Like, is that this part of the spoof that it's kind of the same stuff? That said, like, I did really enjoy the introduction of the Statesman and like that whole, you know, kind of expand the scope in the world a little bit. I thought that stuff was a lot of fun, but it does kind of, it did start to drag on me a bit as we get, you know, as things progress, and we're just kind of doing the same stuff we've done already.
Yeah, that's the thing. I feel like it kind of doubles down on everything from the first movie. Like, every dark joke, every, like, bit of violence, every sex joke, every, like, everything that happened in the first movie, this kind of, like, amplifies. And I think in doing that, like, it is kind of there's a lot of fun stuff going on in here. And I think overall I liked Kingsman 2. Like, I liked the movie, and I mostly had fun with it. I do think it is kind of a significant step down from the first one. I think part of it is the surprise has kind of worn off, I guess. I think that might be a little bit of it. This sequel doesn't really bring much to the table that the first one hadn't already done and had done better in most cases. But I think its big problem is the Statesman, which is a great bit of world building. And I really enjoyed seeing like Channing Tatum show up and Jeff Bridges and all that stuff. But, it kind of stops the movie's narrative like dead. You know, as it kind of just takes time to establish like a whole movie's worth of new characters. Like, it felt,
that's true. It is like a full cast. Yeah. Right.
Like, it felt like what people accuse the Marvel Cinematic Universe of sometimes being, where it's like, oh, they're just setting up for the sequels or the spinoffs or whatever. Like, that's kind of what it felt like with all the Statesman stuff.
You know, to be honest, yeah. Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
I was done.
But yeah, I do agree that it does. The thing that I was going to say is I feel like there's even a moment where they use or spoof or whatever you want to call it, like the kind of Avengers theme. There's definitely a moment in the score where that kind of I can't, you know, sing it or anything like that. But there's like a swell that sounded a lot like Avengers music to me. And I was just kind of like had that thought of like, are they making fun? They're probably making fun of that whole kind of like expanded cinematic universe thing.
Yeah.
But that, and I do agree with you that the Statesman feels like that could have been its own movie, like our own movie to be a Statesman. And then we'd have Kingsman and Statesman in the third movie, right? in a different kind of franchise, I guess, is what I mean.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think the movie, because of that, the movie does, like, meander a lot. Especially for that, like, middle, like, after that first action scene, there's like, a full hour where there's, like, no action at all. And it's just, like, you know.
Yeah.
They'll maybe pull off, they'll do a mission or something, or they're just kind of, like, introducing new characters left and right. And I feel like it's kind of aimless for a lot of the runtime, which, by the way, is 2 hours and 20 minutes, and it's way too long.
Yes, yes, I definitely agree.
Like I was stressed out by how long this movie was by the time it was over. You know, like it was, and it's not like it's not even like significantly longer than the first movie. I think the first movie is like 2 hours and 10 minutes, but I feel like that original movie is paced a lot better. So you're kind of like, you know, you're into Eggsy's world at first, and you're kind of introduced to him, and you're seeing this new Kingsman world through his eyes. And in this movie, Eggsman's already part of the, or Eggsy's already part of the Kingsman. You know, he's already kind of, he's still learning and he's still like establishing himself in the Kingsman world. But you're also introducing so many other new elements that, because you're introducing so much of them, you're not really giving any of them enough moment to shine, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And a lot of them do pop up and then immediately die.
This is true too.
But that kind of takes away, like it feels like we're just loading cannon fodder for a while.
Yeah. But I do think that the movie does find a groove again for Act 3. And I think the climax is every bit as insane as I could have hoped for. Like, it's a lot of fun once they finally arrive at the villain's compound. And I don't think anything ever reaches the glory of that church scene from the original. But there is a bunch of fun stuff going on here. And Julianne Moore, man, I think she's great in this movie. Like, she's really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I was a little nervous at first, I think, when they kind of show us, like, remember what we did at the end of the last one? And, like, we show the security camera footage of everyone's fucking rainbow heads exploding.
Right.
And I was a little nervous that they were going to, like, I was afraid it was going to be like you just kind of like trip down memory lane a little bit. And, you know, what we've kind of been saying, like a little bit of just a rehash of that old stuff we did in the first movie.
Yeah.
But I think you're definitely right. That third act when we're at Poppy Land or whatever the hell it's called at the compound is just full on bananas. And it's so silly and a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I don't think it ever gets as insane as that rainbow explodey thing at the end of the first movie, which, again, I think that is incredible. Like, that whole sequence is amazing. And that's the thing. I think this movie has, like, it probably has, like, the same level of insanity that the first one does, but I feel like because it's, like, padded out more, it feels like there's less of it, even though it's probably about the same in that case. But, about Julianne Moore, though, I think she is, like, a pretty interesting companion to Samuel L. Jackson in the original movie. Like, they both kind of have similar agendas. Both of their evil plans are actually working towards something for the betterment of humanity in their weird way. They're just going about it in a really twisted and evil fashion. in the first movie, Samuel Jackson is an environmental activist who's trying to stop global warming, essentially.
By killing everybody.
By killing everyone in the world, yeah. But still, good intentions.
yeah, you're right.
And in this movie, Julianne Moore's character is just trying to legalize weed. Is basically all she's doing, right?
Yeah. I don't remember what her phrase was. Oh, man. What was it? It was like, save a life, legalize it, or something like that. I can't remember.
Something like that.
But yeah. There's some weird, kind of activist hashtag that she uses. But yeah, I think that is an interesting twist on that kind of just evil villain archetype of just wants to kill everyone in the world. But from their point of view, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Or like it serves a greater purpose. That's kind of it. I think that is an interesting thing. I think it does border on some weird politics stuff, but I'm down for all that.
Well, it does border on some weird politics stuff. I mean, it's
yeah,
it's a weirdly, Like, people have, like, argued that Kingsman is, like, a very conservative franchise. And I can sort of see where they're coming from in that regard. Not conservative in, like, it's not willing to try to take risks or anything, but, like, conservative is, like, politically aligned. But, and I can sort of see where they're coming from with that because of the plots of the villains in these movies.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know. It's using that as a... I have no defense against that. I just don't. I didn't feel that, I guess, when I was watching the movie.
Yeah.
It feels like it's using that as a springboard to kind of it's subverting James Bond in its own weird way, and I think it's doing it pretty effectively. That said, it is a 20th Century Fox movie, and it does make it known that it's a 20th Century Fox movie by having all the news channels be Fox News.
Oh, shit. You know, I really wondered why it was only Fox News. That makes so much sense. Oh, my God.
So that might back up the conservative argument at least a little bit. But actually, there is some stuff I did want to talk about in spoilers regarding that. Okay. So I'll talk about that in a bit, too. But I do think the movie also builds upon some threads from the first movie in pretty interesting and like cool ways. I mean, there's characters in the first movie who I didn't think I would see again showing up in this one. So I think that was pretty neat. I'm still pretty unsure if I needed Colin Firth to be back for this thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I think there is definitely a surprising amount of continuity. I was not expecting anything on that level. Yeah. But yeah, I agree though with Colin Firth's character. It seems kind of like a way to just introduce the, you know, one of my favorite bits from Thank You for Smoking with the "Thank God we invented that oxygen machine." That where we can just like retcon a thing and I guess it's a retcon. Yeah. Just like invent a plot point for why he's alive and allow us to save other people later and stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't know if he serves a whole lot other than just being a kind of like emotional impetus for Eggsy's character.
Right.
And even then it's not very effective, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. It feels weird. It's cool that he's back. I want to see action hero Colin Firth, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does kind of undercut his death in the original movie. And I think that might be even kind of the intention. I feel like I saw an article kind of arguing in favor of it because, you know, part of the thing, like, if the subversion of the James Bond tropes, the big thing about James Bond is that James Bond can never die. And so even when he's shot, like, directly in the head, like, you know, that's something that James Bond could probably come back from. And so this is kind of poking fun at that. And so I could sort of see that. And, like, basically anything in this movie that, like, people might have, like, an issue, take issue with, like, I feel like you can probably point to as, like, this, but it's subverting this James Bond thing in that sense. So I don't know. I mean, I think I still feel like I might have rather him stay dead and let more of a spotlight be drawn to some of the other characters. Like, you know, I mean, have Mark Strong. Mark Strong does play a pretty big role in this movie. But even, like, have Roxy play a bigger role or something like that. Or have Channing Tatum be a bigger part of this movie. Because we'll talk about what happens to Channing Tatum in spoilers. But he's in very little of this movie.
That's true. I do also want to point out or raise the question. Did John Denver's music go into the public domain recently? Because this is the second movie where, I don't even know what the name of that song is. Is it Take Me Home Country Road or whatever the name of the song is?
Yes.
It's like Saves the Day that we've reviewed in the last like month and a half, 2 months.
Both of those movies, by the way, feature Channing Tatum. But also, it's not just those two movies. This has been like a thing online. I don't know if you've been following this at all.
No, I haven't.
There have been five or six major movies this year that have prominently featured John Denver songs. And all of them are like not even just like playing in the background of a scene, but they're like they're significant to the plot of the movie in some way.
Alien Covenant characters singing them.
Alien Covenant played a John Denver song. I think it also was Take Me Home Country Roads. Okja, I think, featured two John Denver songs. And then what else? What was the other one? Free Fire. Free Fire also had a John Denver song in there too. And I think the new Diary of Wimpy Kid movie also had one in there too. So there's a lot of John Denver in the movies this year. And I feel like at this point we can put a moratorium on it. I think Logan Lucky did a really great job with their Denver moment. And Kingsman 2 kind of puts the final note in it. Like, it has to end right now.
There's nothing that can beat what happens in Kingsman 2.
I'm pretty sure. Doesn't John Denver play in Final Destination? Isn't that like the note? That's the song that plays throughout that movie that signifies that death is about to come.
Probably.
I'm pretty sure
it's been a while since I've seen it.
I'm pretty sure it's a John Denver song. That's like the last example I can think of a John Denver song being in a movie. And that was 17 years ago. And suddenly there's like a bunch.
Yeah.
all happening at once. Anyway, So is there any other stuff in Kingsman you want to talk about before we move on to spoilers, Mike?
No, I think let's get into spoilers.
All right, let's do that. Let's move on into spoilers for Kingsman: The Golden Circle, starting right now. All right, so spoilers for Kingsman: The Golden Circle, starting right now. Now, Mike, I had my problems with Kingsman 2, but it did give me the gift of Elton John drop-kicking motherfuckers in the face. So
yes, they goddamn did.
I got to give it a pass.
Yeah. Bizarre. Absolutely bizarre.
I mean, that was an amazing cameo right there. That was just like balls to the wall nuts.
And I do actually really appreciate the fucking the foreshadowing of it. I don't know if you saw it. There's
Benny
a moment.
The robots are named Benny and Jet, right? Like that was.
Well, that too. No, there's the moment when Eggsy's friend is babysitting or dog sitting, and he goes into his office. And this is one of my favorite bits of continuity where he's got the three. Front page of the newspapers on the wall behind him, which is like the, you know, they take the newspaper for the day they save the world or something like that, I think.
Yeah.
The first one. One of the headlines, though, says Elton John missing. or Elton is gone. That's what it says. So I thought that was hilarious. I was like, what? That's weird. Like, that's a weird thing to have, like, as a fake newspaper.
Yep.
And then he shows up later in the full feather late 70s Elton John getup, like glam rock. Amazing.
Yeah, that was pretty great. Otherwise, other spoilery things. I did want to point out that Kingsman 2 depicts a magical fantasy land in which a president lies to and endangers the people of the world and is then swiftly impeached.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, optimistic look on American politics.
Yeah, isn't that something? That is
super. Actively tries to kill lots of people. And then is impeached.
Yeah.
Who? That's too far. I can't believe it. My suspension of disbelief can only go so far.
But speaking of that, apparently, and what I was talking about before in terms of the conservative thing, apparently the original intent was to make the president a lot more like Trump in this movie. And when they were making the movie, the election was still going on, like when it was filming. So it was still like they would have been taking a guess whether it was Trump or Hillary. And apparently Matthew Vaughn was saying that he, like, I think it was right after Brexit happened, and he was like, "Shit, Trump might actually win."
Yeah,
and he was thinking like, "Okay, we have to scale this back a little bit." Like, I think because he looks at it as like, you know, this sort of escapist thing. He didn't want people to be reminded of reality, I guess, is what his argument was.
Right.
But apparently, the intent was to make it more like Trump. Like, he was describing it as like, instead of the White House, they were going to paint have this like golden building that he would live in and that kind of thing. and God. Damn, do I wish they had leaned into that. I mean, that
would have been amazing.
That would have been crazy cool. I mean, it would have pissed Trump off, which is always fun. But, I mean, they blew up Obama's head in the first one. Do you remember that? Like, that?
I forgot that happened.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
Like, if you can blow up the previous president's head, you can depict the current president as the worst.
Yeah, true.
That said, I did... and Bruce Greenwood plays president in this movie. I think it's a really effective bit of satire having the president deciding to let everyone die to win the war on drugs. I feel like it's more of a satire of like George W. Bush era presidency than it is anything else. I feel like that's like if this had come out in like 2005, that would be biting. Like that would be really insensitive.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think it was an effective skewering of like that
conservative like persona.
Yeah, just that kind of general conservative. Everyone that has ever done drugs is a felon and deserves to die. Like mentality. So I did appreciate that. I didn't know that they had scaled back the Trumpiness. I wish they had gone just full blown.
Yeah, no, I feel like
that would have been amazing.
Yeah, that would have been insane. I think that would have been kind of incredible, but unfortunately, that was not meant to be. Also, wanted to mention that vagina shot though.
Which one?
I mean, was it more the main one? Yeah. was there more than one? So there's a scene in the movie where Eggsy has to seduce this girl and implant a tracker into her mucous membrane that happens to be located in her vagina, and so so basically the idea behind this sequence is that Eggsy has to finger this girl, and that's like the, that is his mission and it is like, it's a really like weird, and I'm not sure totally, it's a weird tangent that the movie takes for sure. That's one, yeah, that's one of the meandering kind of bits where it's just like, okay, why are we doing this?
It honestly felt a lot like a like paid Glastonbury like plug thing, because they say Glastonbury at least a million times during that sequence.
True. Yeah, that's very true. But yeah, anyway, in that sequence when Eggsy finally like gets his hand in the girl's pants, the camera like, you know, zooms down Eggsy's arm and it goes through the girl's underwear and it just goes straight up.
Yeah, and yeah,
yeah. That's I don't think I've ever seen anything like that shot in a mainstream non-porn film. There's been like art house movies I've watched where like that kind of shot has been in there, like something like Gaspar Noé has.
Yeah, some fucking Lars von Trier shit.
Yeah, but that was like really weird to see in a theater, in like a packed movie theater. Like, right? You tell everybody around me was just like, this is weird. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so wanted to mention that as like a very odd bit there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, any other scenes that you want to talk about, Mike? Mark Strong's death scene, perhaps?
Yeah, Mark Strong's whole performance. I love Mark Strong.
Yeah, me too.
And I think that his whole role as Merlin in this movie is incredible. I think the moments with him and Halle Berry, where they're kind of doing their like techie thing together, is fun. Yeah. But yeah, his belting Country Roads. Take Me Home, or take whatever the name of the actual song is. Take Me Home, Country Roads. It's just beautiful. It's beautiful.
Just him with like his monotone Scottish accent, like,
yeah,
just like,
it's like a dirge.
Home.
Yeah,
yeah. That was pretty great. And I mean, I was upset that they killed him off, but also like they brought Colin Firth back, so I'm assuming he's going to be back in Kingsman 3. Like that's kind of
maybe the alpha gel can work on everything.
Good. You never know.
You don't know.
Yeah, so that was cool. So I did like his death scene. I was not a fan of the fact that they killed Roxy in this movie, the female agent from the first movie, who is one of the casualties of the beginning where Julianne Moore's character bombs most of the Kingsman buildings. And it's weird. You kind of see Roxy like jump out of the way, like she notices it and says like, "Oh shit," and she jumps. But then you never see her again. So I'm
I thought they were gonna pull one of those like she survives things. And then the entire building collapses into a giant cavern. I was like, no, maybe not.
Probably not. I mean,
probably not.
I feel like they could pull something in Kingsman 3, just like, oh, I was in a secret tube or something, and that would be that.
A secret tube.
That would be less ridiculous than what happens in this movie. For Colin
I was in an alpha tube. I do agree though that there's a lot of that kind of stuff that just gets annihilated pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I do think I feel like part of it is like you know, they were bringing Colin Firth back for this movie, and I feel like to compensate for that, they killed off a bunch of other characters, so it felt like there was stakes, I guess.
In that
kind of sense. So the fact that Roxy died, she was kind of one of the better characters in the first movie, but she's kind of under. Like she doesn't have that big of a part in that movie, and I would I was hoping that her part would be expanded some way, but she's killed off within the first 20 minutes of the movie, so that was a bummer for sure. But I was a fan of characters like the Princess Tildy and Charlie having a larger role in this movie than they had in the first one. So Princess Tildy, is the girl at the end of the first movie.
I thought so. I was trying to remember. Yeah,
that allows
the other vagina shot.
That was an ass shot, man. Keep up.
Right,
that was
fair enough.
She was the girl at the end of the first movie that allows Eggsy to have sex with her after he saves the world. And that is a pretty controversial ending to that movie. I don't know if you've ever looked at any of the online discourse surrounding Kingsman. People are very divided. People are very divided about the ending of Kingsman, with a lot of people saying it's sexist, other people saying it's pretty pretty funny subversion of what James Bond does, because he always gets rewarded with sex at the end of the day. So, you know, it's, you know, I don't want to get into all that, but I do like that she kind of has more of a character in this movie. And she's like, you know, part of it. And like, even she's kind of part of the action in some way. Like, I mean, she's partially a damsel in distress, but also like she's kind of Eggsy's lifeline in a lot of ways. In that scene where he seduces the girl that he has to plant the tracker on, he feels a lot of guilt because he's dating Princess Tildy, and actually like FaceTimes her and like asks her permission, like makes sure it's okay that he does this, and naturally she gets upset and all that, and it's also like a pretty funny subversion, because like James Bond would do that shit no problem, like he would, like, he wouldn't care, but Eggsy isn't James Bond, he's like just some guy happens to be a spy. And I think that is kind of what makes the Kingsman movies kind of special in their own way, because they're kind of taking, you know, this larger-than-life James Bond character and just placing it in the context of, like, well, what if this actual kid was this James Bond type? So I like that Tilty had a larger role in this movie. And then Charlie, who was the rejected Kingsman from the first movie, ends up being Julianne Moore's henchman in this movie with a robot arm. And that was cool.
And that's always dope.
Yeah, and that's a character who also looked like he died in the first movie and then came back in this one as well. I don't think the first movie made it look like he died, but it implied that he was probably dead. But he's back, and he ended up being one of the better parts of the movie.
Yeah. What did you think of the Statesman stuff? All those things.
I mean, I think like the characters themselves were fun. Channing Tatum in his action scene is great. And I was kind of bummed that he was kind of literally put on ice for the majority of this movie. And you know, I think they're setting him up for a bigger role in Kingsman 3 is what it seemed like.
Yeah,
I guess what happened is he did have a bigger role in Kingsman 2, and then his schedule kind of shifted around. He had other movies they had to make that he was required to make. And so they kind of shifted most of his character stuff to Pedro Pascal.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So apparently Channing Tatum was even the one with the whip early on, like, originally when the movie was being made, and they gave that to Pedro as well. And Pedro Pascal, great too. I mean, he was Oberyn Martell in Game of Thrones. And it's cool to see him have this role, like, pretty significant role in this pretty big action movie. And he does great work, and his whip stuff is fantastic. Like, his whip is so much fun.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be said for the choreography of all of the fight scenes in this movie, and then Kingsman 1. I think that's some of my favorite stuff that they're doing. The just very frenetic, crazy camera movements that, like, as we're following people over tables, the camera flips, spins over, and, like, all this weird, silly shit that just makes it a lot of fun to watch. And it's impressive that, for the most part, you can follow all of it. There's no crazy, quick cuts. I think it's all edited to sort of be one take. It seems like they're trying to make it look that way, at least.
No, I agree. I agree with that, and I think part of it is the action is kind of the best thing about these Kingsman movies. And you know, the first one, you know, has so many memorable scenes. There's the church scene, obviously. There's the skydiving scene. There's the manners maketh man scene. There's the entire climax with the fucking heads exploding. It's amazing. And you know, there's so much cool stuff. And the first one had Gazelle also, who was the coolest. Sophia Batella's character. And this one has probably the same amount of action, but again, it's just paced out, you know, it's differently. And so there's like a long stretch where there's no action going on, and the movie isn't playing to its strengths at that point. I feel like I needed more stuff going on in action scenes, more memorable scenes, because the scenes that do have action are really cool. The opening action scene, man, it's great. Like close quarters car combat between Eggsy and Charlie. It's really cool. Also, I believe the first time a Prince song has been used in a non-Prince movie.
Every fight scene needs to be choreographed to a Prince song from now on. That was amazing.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. It was Let's Go Crazy from Prince, and it was pretty neat. And then, you know, there's the scenes later on. I mean, the fights with Pedro Pascal, where he's just taking out like 12 dudes at once with the whip, is really cool. I did like that Colin Firth saw his betrayal coming, and that was kind of, I think that was played really well, where at this point, like, he's still recovering from the effects of that amnesia that he had because of the wibbly wobbly head returning nonsense or whatever. But anyway, he's like recovering, so he's still having like flashes of like butterflies and stuff like that. And you know, he's the one who first sees that Pedro Pascal is betraying them, so he shoots him right in the head, and then they bring him back to life because that's something they can do in this universe now. And then he betrays them, and that's what he does. You know, I like that's kind of part of the relationship that he and Eggsy have together, where Eggsy thinks, you know, his mentor is going insane, and Colin Firth thinks he might even be going insane too, but he ends up being right, and it works out. And that whole fight sequence that they all have together at the end in Julianne Moore's compound is pretty great. And that kind of, that's the end of the movie, right? That last fight scene, because Julianne Moore dies before any of that shit goes down.
Before that fight scene,
which was kind of a bummer to me, because she was a really good villain, and also I felt like she should have had a bigger part in the climax, I guess, in that regard. I mean, I think Samuel Jackson made it to the end of Kingsman 1, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so.
Yeah, or at least up until the point where all the heads were exploding. I feel like we keep mentioning the heads exploding part, but really, that is such a phenomenal visual.
It's so iconic. Yeah. It's so bizarre.
But we didn't really talk about Julianne Moore's character in this movie, but she's kind of like this 50s homemaker like style. Like she lives in like this land of 50s nostalgia where there's like diners and milkshakes and all that stuff. And her workers are like these guys who are dedicated and loyal to her. Like she makes them eat the previous people who betrayed her. That kind of thing. It's really fucked up. And I think she's doing really good work in this movie too. And she's great in general. So I was kind of excited to see her playing, like, she really like sunk her teeth into this villainous role. But it's a villainous role with like a nice facade. And I think it's really interesting stuff that she's playing there.
Yeah. I think it's a lot of fun to see her do that, especially the, it's the politics thing too, that whole angle that if you sell alcohol or tobacco, you're a Fortune 500 company and that's all she wants to be. She just wants to be recognized.
Yeah.
I guess on top of killing everyone, but I thought that was an interesting, interesting point to make in the middle of this insane action movie.
Yeah.
But I think that we've said it a bunch of times already. That climax, that gunfight when they get into the compound,
yeah,
and they're hiding behind the rolling giant donut. It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
It is so good. But at the same time, I did feel like Colin Firth just kind of jumps back into the action at that point.
Yeah.
And he's somebody like, when he first shows up and does his first action scene in the first Kingsman, that Manners Maketh Man scene, that mm-hmm. thing is amazing. That's such a great introduction to what he's capable of being able to do. And I feel like I wanted something like that in this movie, and I didn't really get it. You know what I mean? There's a moment where it seems like it's about to happen with the Manners Maketh Man again. And then he fails it and Pedro Pascal ends up taking over and doing that whole thing. But I feel like, part of this movie is Colin Firth kind of recuperating from his amnesia. And I feel like I needed that moment at the end where there's like this, I wanted that fuck yeah, Colin Firth moment where he does this like amazing thing on his own. And the music will swell and all that. And then I didn't really feel like I got that. He just kind of jumped back into the action scene and was doing a lot of cool shit. But there wasn't like one moment that made me go like, yes, Colin Firth. It reminded me actually of Twin Peaks. I mean, everything does, obviously. But
what doesn't?
But this past season, Twin Peaks, we waited so long to see Dougie Jones become Dale Cooper again. And that moment where he wakes up from the coma and says he's back 100% and he says, I am the FBI. Like, that's such a fuck yeah Dale Cooper moment. It's amazing. And that's like, I was actually thinking about that when I was watching the movie. Like, this is Dougie Jones all over again. Like, I'm waiting for Colin Firth to return back to his former self.
It really is.
But I don't feel like I ever got that I am the FBI moment from Colin Firth, even though he does a lot of cool stuff towards the end of this movie.
Yeah, it just, you're right, it just sort of happens. We're just there again. There's no, like, the light turns on moment kind of thing.
Yeah, but yeah, anyway, otherwise, I mean, I don't have that much else I wanted to mention. Do you have any other scenes that you wanted to call attention to, Mike, for Kingsman 2, or should we wrap up?
No, I think we talked enough about it.
Okay, cool beans. I think it's a fun movie. Like, it's really entertaining. It's a little too long and it could have cut like a lot of stuff. And I think it needs to be a little more action oriented. It doesn't play to its strengths, as much as it could. And as a sequel to the first one though, it's solid. I think it's fine. And I will watch Kingsman 3 when it comes out. And I think it can learn from any of the mistakes that this one had and do something really cool. So, anyway, that is our review of Kingsman, the Golden Circle. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Plus, I got some work at crookedmarquee.com. You can check me out there as well. Thank you so much for listening to FilmBookCast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail, they can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast, where we'll have a full recap of my experience at New York Comic Con 2017. So very much looking forward to that. That's in a couple of days. And then plus, hopefully shortly after that, we'll be talking Blade Runner 2049. I think that's the idea as of right now. And then after that, you can check out our next complete works, where we're talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2006's The Wicker Man. And that is very exciting.
it's going to be a crazy couple weeks while Comic-Con messes up all of our plans.
Yep.
But
definitely.
We'll get through it.
Yeah, we'll make it through. So thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out. Secret agent man, secret agent.